are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, Sarah Igo, on The Known Citizen, a history of privacy in modern America. Also on the program today, the Southern District of New York digging deep into the Trump inauguration files, subpoenas issued. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi's aide tells insurance executives, we won't be pushing for Medicare for all. And oh yeah, Trump giving a State of the Union address tonight. Stacey Abrams with a response. Meanwhile, Democratic voters care less about policy than beating Trump, according to Democratic voters. And is the U.S. government behind blocking the travel of journalists and immigrant rights lawyers to Mexico? Meanwhile, the Trump is shut down on his national emergency gambit. And surprise, surprise, Donald Trump's Interior Department head is a former oil lobbyist. Lastly, AOC readies her Green New Deal bill as details are revealed. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us. We will be tonight. This will be our first broadcast of the day. As you know, we always like to do multiple shows a day. And tonight,
actually, really kind of do if you broaden that out.
It depends. We usually that's true. But Tuesdays is usually two shows emanating out of the studio. Anyways, tonight, however, will be the State of the Union address. Super excited. I'm sure all of you are very excited to hear what Donald Trump has to say. I actually am excited to see Stacey Abrams speak in response. That is always a thankless job, and very few people have come out of that with a more positive, I guess, glow around them than they went in. Although there's been a couple. I thought Kennedy did okay last time, and Jim Webb years ago.
Jim Webb years ago supposedly crushed it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But he did quite well. We shall see. Excited to see that. And of course, I'm also excited to see the sixth grader that Donald Trump has invited to the State of the Union, who apparently is picked on because his last name is Trump.
That matters is me.
That's right.
I'm the only one that matters.
You know, I really empathize with that kid.
Why doesn't the New York Times write a nice article about me? I'm my hometown paper.
I'm entitled to at least one. So, I came from Jamaica Estates.
We will be starting around 8:30. We will also be drinking, as my sense, probably heavily. And so do join us. do join us for that this evening. Let's play this this clip. I'm so torn as to which one.
Go with your gut.
Let's go with the first one that we saw. We'll do the other one about the State of the Union later. That is just, you know. Now
it does line up the question of tonight.
Now, look, I don't know. Well, yeah, we can ask that question later. We'll do that one at the end of the show. AOC is releasing her Green New Deal shortly. So, of course, Fox News is on a 24-hour state of alert. And they keep it on their chyron. But here they have, what's this guy's name again now?
Charles Payne.
Yeah, Charles Payne. They bring him on. And this clip fascinated me because I got totally misdirected. I thought where this was going. Now I want you to listen to this conversation. They're talking about the polling that shows that people support a wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren is proposing. They support AOC's tax to 70% on the top marginal rate of $10 million or over. They're going to support Bernie Sanders, a similar call for such taxation as well. They're really amazed about it. But Payne makes an argument that, you listen, but I want you to just, as you hear Payne talk, right? There's three people here. There's Bill Hemmer, who's not going to say very much. Sometimes he gets a little bit of a stomach virus, if you know what I mean.
Enjoying himself. And, yeah, maybe a little bit more enjoyable than a stomach virus.
Yeah, and I don't. Who is the other? I don't know the other host on Fox. Hemmer's just sitting there looking a little goofy, and then Payne comes on. So I want you just to think as Payne starts to talk about his argument, like where you think it's going, because he does a double Lindy, as far as I'm concerned. Go ahead.
There is what seems to be a movement against capitalism in this country. This is a piece in Politico just published.
Pause it for
rich.
1 second. You know, we should say that taxation is a big part of capitalism. It really is a big part. I mean, there's nothing anti-capitalist about taxation. In many respects, it's the first of all. Taxation is the only thing that gives our money value, or I should say is the primary thing that gives our money value. It is the but for. If the government did not take taxes in U.S. dollars, your money would not have much value. That's just the reality of it, folks. Putting that aside, there is an anti-capitalist sentiment growing in the United States. It's just she's just not picking out the right things that are indicating it.
Just soak the rich. Americans say go for it. In this piece, it talks about how recent polling is showing that the American public is increasingly on board with raising taxes on the rich. As evidence, we pulled up this latest Fox News poll on the issue, whether Americans support raising taxes on the wealthy, on incomes over $10 million. Those that are in favor of that, 70%, Charles, over $1 million in income, 65% are in favor of raising taxes.
Pause it for 1 second. I'm also super impressed with how sort of incredulous she seems like.
I mean, doesn't that just seem so beyond commonsensical?
She is a good actress, right? Like, yeah. So you feel like she could be delivering like, oh my God, there's a doorknob on that door.
It's not butter.
But she does sound like she's talking about like AOC is actually proposing like putting the head of Exxon in jail.
Right, exactly.
If they ask the question, like, should we tax 70% of their total income over $10 million? Or, it seems like people don't understand marginal tax rates still when they're answering this question, which makes it even more impressive.
Right.
Over $1 million in income, 65% are in favor of raising taxes.
The idea of fairness has been promoted in our schools for a long time. And we're starting to see kids who grew up in this notion that fairness above all, and now they're becoming voting age, and they're bringing this ideology with them.
So explain misdirection.
Do you get that?
Explain
it. As soon as he starts talking about fairness, I thought he was going to say, look, kids are taught about fairness in school, and it is unfair to ask the rich to pay more. But no, he is bemoaning the fact that the idea of fairness is gaining traction in society.
This should be the new tagline of MR, by the way. fairness above all.
Right.
The Majority Report.
Sorry. We believe in fairness. We're going to be handing out a nice big dose of fairness. Get used
Caution,
to it.
Caution, you're about to enter an all fairness zone.
He's bemoaning the fact that fairness is becoming an ascendant ideology.
This is fairness warriors.
Total fairness warriors.
SFW.
That's actually much more what I am. I'm a social fairness warrior.
And not just social. EFW.
Oh, yeah.
Economic fairness.
Oh, I'm a big-time economic fairness warrior.
Can this guy really, honestly, are there really people listening to Fox, watching Fox going like, ugh, fairness. What's next?
Yeah, there are a handful of old people who should be frankly assembling a class action lawsuit against these people for jacking their cortisol levels up every day, who probably are just being like, that's like Venezuela. I bet they're all about fairness in Venezuela.
How much fairness are they going to just keep heaping on us?
It's just so bored of fairness.
Oh, my God. That is,
we get it fair.
They are so turned around now. Like, they have to resort towards sort of fake astonishment that 70% want to tax people over the first $10 million. Like, really? Really? Did they think they took this poll in the commissary in Fox? Like, you know, we only polled the hosts of Fox News, and that was surprising.
You mean
actually.
Like running around like, no, don't ask the fucking makeup person.
Oh my gosh. Exactly.
I guess they're not still using the slogan fair and balanced, are they?
Oh, disgusting.
That's
coming from inside the house.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Folks, support for today's show comes from Third Love. Using millions of real women's measurements, Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and an incredible feel. Just answer a few simple questions from Third Love's Fit Finder quiz to find your perfect fit. Third Love offers double the number of sizes most brands offer, cups A through H, bands up to 48, and with lightweight memory foam cups, straps that won't slip, tagless labels. You'll want to wear these soft, breathable bras and underwear every day, especially the new cotton T-shirt bras and underwear. Thanks to the 100% fit guarantee, returns and exchanges are free and easy. Maybe even fair.
A fair policy for a show built on the foundation of fairness above
so,
all.
So we have We recruited a special bra wearer to get an endorsement, because I obviously don't wear bras, and so I don't really assess
obvious,
them.
But okay,
I don't. This is what we heard back. I love that they don't have a zillion options. It's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most T-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you go, folks. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority. Find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off. Also, folks, you spend one third of your life in your sheets. I spend about, I would say, 75% of that staring at the ceiling.
Really that high?
I have trouble sleeping. Damn. But I love my sheets. It's about time for a bedding upgrade for you folks. Founded in early 2014, Brooklinen is the fastest growing bedding brand in the world, with over 30,000 five-star reviews, 500,000 happy sleepers, and counting. Their mission is to make five-star hotel quality sheets that are affordable and easy to order. And since they believe that sheets should look great in addition to feeling great, they offer over 20 colors and patterns. You can mix and match. I now have four sets of Brooklinen sheets.
What kind of colors you got going on?
I got stripes. I got stripes. Nice. So they discontinued the stripes. And so I got the reverse stripe. So they have, I've got the hard stripes And then I have the, it's sort of like gray with like tiny white stripes. So the absence of gray, I guess. If you want to put it that way. Well, it depends on how you...
Poetic relationship to your sheets.
But I love them. I get the crisp, cool cotton ones, and I love them. They're incredibly comfortable. I know they're going to last a long time. Cotton sheets like this, I've had sets of those in the past for ages, and I love them. My Brooklyn sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I have ever slept on. And now it's time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer for just my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping. And free shipping when you use promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get $20 off and the free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever. And lastly, got a new sponsor. And Kelly helped out with this. Old Kelly.
This is cool.
Your dog's health is as important as every other member of your family, and it starts with what you feed them. Ollie offers vet-formulated recipes, fully transparent ingredients to give your dog the healthiest food possible. We're talking real, all-natural, that even people can eat. I don't know that you want to do that, but no preservatives and sourced from U.S. family farms. No wonder Ollie beat out store-bought dog food at a 10-to-1 on the palatability scale. Try for yourself. Just go to myollie.com. Answer a few questions about your dog. They'll ship custom recipes and pre-proportioned meals straight to your door on a regular schedule. Shipping is free, and if your dog doesn't like the meals, they have a money-back guarantee. Best of all, Ollie is offering our listeners 60% off your first box plus a free bag of treats at myollie.com/majority. So that's a tricky one. myollie.com/try/majority. Check it out. This is what Kelly said about Ollie. She said, Edie loves Ollie. Spent a lot of time cooking for my elderly dog. So when I got Edie as a puppy, I was relieved I didn't have to cook anymore and could feed her store-bought kibble, but I knew it wasn't the best for her health, and I've always felt a bit guilty. Ollie is an amazing solution for dog owners like me. The delivery was fast. The packaging was 100% recycled and biodegradable. Took me a couple answers to answer a few questions about my dog, and Ollie recommended one of their recipes. The order arrived within 2 days. The instructions were simple. Phase Ollie into Edie's diet using portions based on the scoop they provided. Store the food in the fridge using the reusable lid they provided. There was no reason to phase in the food, despite the fact that every other food change has given Edie a little bit of adjustment. Ollie meals were easy for her to digest. She's excited when I take the food out of the fridge. I plan on using Ollie moving forward, even if it's only to mix with her kibble. Human-grade food is clearly what she prefers, and it's the best for her health. Kelly's very excited about it. Go to myollie.com/try/majority for 60% off, plus a free bag of treats. Spelled myollie.com/try/majority. All right, quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Sarah Igo. Right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, author of The Known Citizen, A History of Privacy in Modern America. Sarah Igo, thanks so much for coming on to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start. Let's start with the title. It is a reference to a poem by W.H. Auden from 1940, "The Unknown Citizen." What was it about that that poem that spurred the title?
I'm so glad you asked that. It's a lovely poem. It is, as you say, from 1940, and a poem that charts the life of a man who is anonymous. He's never named in the poem, but is known by all kinds of different agencies in the society. You know, his creditors, his doctors, labor union, journalists, pollsters, and so forth. And when I stumbled upon it, it just spoke to me in the way that it captured a dilemma for Americans around privacy, which is both their desire to be known and their desire to be unknown at the same time, or maybe better, their desire to be known as they wish, but usually aren't. So it really, I don't know, in a kind of very succinct way seemed to capture up many of the themes that I was thinking about in terms of the history of American debates over privacy, and to eloquently, you know, lay them in front of us.
Let's talk. I feel like it's too broad of a question to ask, like, what is privacy? But I think that's sort of in many respects, that's the point of the book, is that it shifts, the concept of it shifts over time. And you start to track it basically at the beginning of the 20th century, just a little bit maybe before that. So let's do that. I mean, in terms of, and hit some of the milestones, but where... When did the concept of privacy really become most, establish itself on the scene, as it were, within the context of society?
Sure. So, I mean, privacy, I think, is a very old human concept, even if it's been, taken different forms. So I would not say it began in any simple way in the late 19th century, which is where I begin the book. But what I do want to argue is that privacy became a kind of public issue, a political issue, for the first time for many people in American society. And that it never really left the stage thereafter, obviously not today, but really for all the years in between. So what happens in the late 19th century is that a series of developments, the kind of creation of the national mass media, some technological innovations, photography, instantaneous photography, fingerprinting, a whole bunch of other things, start to create a crisis in the boundaries around private persons, and to raise questions about what could and should be known about Americans. How should they be known to the broader society? So it's sparked in the first instance really by new technologies and new media. So in some ways, it has some interesting correspondences, I think, to our own moment. But, you know, more than a century ago, we're talking about the 1880s and 1890s, when candid photographs could be circulated easily for the first time, could be printed in the newspaper, where people could be caught unawares and recorded by new kinds of devices. This will provoke for a couple of lawyers the first modern call for the right to privacy, which is in 1890 in the Harvard Law Journal.
And this
so
is,
that's a beginning point. Yeah.
And I want to get to that concept that Brandeis, forwarded, but so at that time, right? I mean, it seems to me that when we're talking right around then too, it's like there's a question of like privacy as anonymity, privacy as sort of control over your domain, you know? And I imagine too, we're talking about an era where for most people, they didn't have a huge amount of property, right? Personal property or whatnot. And there wasn't necessarily, I mean, I guess there's also a question of of like, you know, who can enter my domicile in some way? And all these things get implicated with the technology. And then, as you say, this concept of the right to be left alone is privacy. Let's talk mm-hmm. about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the older ideas about privacy in the United States, certainly legal ideas, had to do with this property idea, right? One's home, a man's home is his castle, which comes out of Anglo, old Anglo American law. And what really changes in the late 19th century is that those borders no longer seem to protect the people that they used to protect, which was generally, you know, white propertied men, to really sort of sum up, you know, who privacy had protected in the past. But suddenly new kinds of communications technologies, virtual technologies like photography could kind of cross those borders and boundaries. So in the first instance, this privacy crisis really is a crisis around upper middle class property rights and the privileged people in American society suddenly realizing they can be witnessed and observed and captured on film and sort of trotted out in the scandal press in a new way. But it doesn't stay there for long. And in fact, this idea that people might have a right to protections from not just physical intrusions, but virtual intrusions, travels really far, really quickly. So you get suits in the late 19th century, some of the earliest right to privacy suits that are actually coming from women whose photographs, whose images are being used in advertising in all kinds of ways that they didn't authorize, didn't even know about oftentimes. And start claiming a right to privacy that is not about, you know, break-ins into one's home or property, but really about incursions on one's reputation, one's image, one's public persona, one's dignity. And so the notion of privacy really changes from one that's based in property, never fully escapes that, but that's really grounded in property, to one that's more grounded in personality, which is the term that Louis Brandeis and Samuel Warren will use in that 1890 Harvard Law Review essay.
Now, is there a distinction at that time between the idea of like, okay, you took my picture, use it for an advertisement, the concept of privacy versus sort of you've taken my property, what we would now, I guess, call on some level intellectual property, right? Because it's interesting that this, that we start to see these suits in the context of, and maybe that's why we only see them in the context of civil suits, but in terms of like issues of exploitation of people's, of things that people don't want to put into the marketplace, but it's an exploitation as opposed to just simply like a leering.
Right. Well, so that's a really interesting question. It's first of all, this market is totally unregulated in the late 19th century. There are no rules about circulation of photographs yet. And so actually there are a number of different reasons one might wish to protest one's image being circulated, but the most common ones are not about having some sort of financial interest or property interest in that sense, but more so about the kind of embarrassment or shame of having one's face kind of paraded around in commercial culture, which particularly for women could seem quite scandalous. I mean, it was to have yourself mixed up in the market and in commercial transactions was akin, you know, in some readings to prostitution or, you know, to a kind of unsavory public presence. So there were a number of different ways that this could play out, but I think it's really a later development of people wanting to profit from, say, their image or to capitalize on their image, and so they're getting more into kind of intellectual property sorts of rights or the, you know, sort of celebrity rights over their image, you know, a right to publicity, actually, which is related in odd ways to a right to privacy.
And
the right profit from publicity, that is.
Okay, and so then, we as we move into the pre, I guess, New Deal era, where sort of the concept of privacy changes. Where are we there? Like, what I mean, it's interesting because we don't have this fear, really, of the government when it comes to privacy, right? It's just other actors around us.
Yeah, well, in the 19th century, that's pretty much true. I mean, certainly there are cases where, and they're sort of memorialized, right, in American law in a way about quartering soldiers or, right, the government breaking down the door. But that was not a very live or regular concern for most Americans in the 19th century, actually. And where the threat comes from is actually commercial entities, other private entities in the first instance. But in the 20th century, as you point out, there starts to be a growing fear about the administrative state, about what the state knows about people, how it is tracking people as a kind of more fully blown social welfare state comes into play. And as more people are paying taxes in the 20th century, people are starting to benefit from federal social programs like Social Security. There's a new regime of documentation around birth certificates. To travel out of the country, one needs a passport. So all of these documents, which seem, age old, but are actually pretty new inventions, come onto the scene and create a new set of worries about documentation, identification by various kinds of state bureaucracies. And I should say not only state bureaucracies even there, because we're also talking about credit agencies and what they know about Americans. Some worry starts to creep in there, too, in the early 20th century. So fears or discussions, debates around privacy change, not to be about just sort of publicity and exposure, but start to encompass worries about information and about what we would now call data privacy or information privacy. People didn't call it that then, but they were clearly starting to worry about all the different kind of pieces of information that various kinds of authorities, private or public, knew about them.
And so this is as we develop into what you call a knowing society, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so, I mean, I'm really fascinated because I wasn't aware, because I was aware that the Social Security number was supposed to be highly limited in terms of its use. And then, of course, it ultimately became far more abused, and we have a lot more, problems associated with, identity theft and whatnot at this point. But I didn't realize how excited people were about the Social Security number because of the implications it had in terms of government. And I wonder how much of the development of, we'll get to how people's perspective on privacy shifted, I think, in the Cold War, because there was, an agenda being set there. But I wonder how much of that sort of table setting was there with the idea of people, because it seems like most of the concern about the Social Security number at that time were of opponents of the idea of Social Security in and of itself. But speak about the different currents of excitement, because I just didn't realize how that people, I think at one point you're saying, people were tattooing their Social Security numbers on them. This,
right,
of course, is before
right.
the
yeah.
Holocaust and, where such, tattoos became, meant something totally different, but people wearing dog tags with it. Talk about that era and the differing views on the Social Security number.
Sure, yeah. This was one of the biggest surprises to me when doing research for this book. I had actually turned to Social Security numbers because I expected that there we would see this early privacy debate about information, right? The state, all of a sudden, first of all, putting a number on people, and then second, being able to use that number to, as a kind of index to their work history, financial lives, and so forth. And there was a little bit of that, although much of the early pushback against Social Security numbers was, as you say, about opponents of the program or about big government or about tracking of union members in particular. And there were some other scattered concerns. But what really bowled me over was the embrace of these numbers, as identifying numbers that would show citizens, would prove, citizen status to the government as deserving of support, whether for unemployment benefits or for social, for welfare, retirement benefits. So there's this really rich kind of material history that I started digging into of, yeah, people getting jewelry with their social security numbers, emblazoned on it, special bronze plates that they would display in their homes, getting their dentures, marked with their social security number, and then this this trend that was, you know, never huge, but was not all that small either, of people getting their social security numbers tattooed on their bodies, you know, permanently making that number part of their identity as a kind of badge of pride and belonging, economic citizenship. You could look at those in a number of different ways, but certainly not hiding them and certainly not treating that number as a kind of private fact about themselves. On the contrary, sometimes really broadcasting that number. And that really carries all the way through the 30s and 40s and into the 50s, and it really only changes, starts to change dramatically in the 1950s, sorry, in the 1960s, when social security numbers start entering into new computer data banks and start getting linked in new ways to other pieces of information.
Before we get to there, too, though, I'm also fascinated by the idea that the social security number was received in part because the concerns that many people had was less about the government and more about their bosses. That
yes.
It seems like
yes.
The social security number was like, okay, here's my token. You no longer have to know what religion I am or what my marital status is or what I, you know, all these other things. Here's the token that just, you know, this, if I'm okay, if this number's okay, then I'm okay. Is that basically the dynamic?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah,
to me.
No, that's right. And also the fact that, you know, workers had been surveilled by their employers for a long time. And there was a lot of distrust and skepticism about employers' intent. And actually, here was the federal government coming in as an intermediary and securing certain kinds of things for workers. And what workers were really worried about was not the government having their information, but making sure the employers would not have access to the government's stashes of information. So, yeah, that was a really interesting discovery that really, you know, just tells you that relationships between Americans and the state were different, right? And private agencies were different than they are today. And we shouldn't assume that their privacy fears were the same as ours, right? Those relationships have really changed over the course of the last century.
I mean, I find that so fascinating. And I'm not, I come with my own predispositions, but I can't help but think that a combination of the Cold War, where we were sold this notion of how dangerous, a government could be, right, in terms of the – and that there was an agenda or a value to the employer class to – sever that relationship that people were feeling between them and their government, and that they wanted to make them more skeptical of their government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it, this is the Social Security number is a nice case, both because Americans seem more trusting than we might expect as a federal government, but also because even though corporate America was very invested in not letting Social Security pass, which of course it did, leapt on the possibilities of the Social Security number for surveilling their employees. So they, I talk about this in some detail in the book, but employers started creating their own fictitious surveys of employees, claiming that they were related to them getting a Social Security number, which they asked for much more extensive information about their personal lives than the federal government ever did. So yeah, that relationship, I think. Is worthy of a second look, right, about the kind of shifting ways in which corporations have both led distrust in the United States and also have fostered distrust in other big agencies, namely the federal government.
That's fascinating. And to what extent, too, and I guess maybe this runs parallel to this, but the idea of who was deserving privacy expands in some way. And I wonder if it, where the Social Security number comes in that respect, too, because that is, on some level, it's the great equalizer, right? I mean, like, everybody gets a number. And, you know, to say you're all just a number, in some ways, maybe dehumanizing, but it's also quite egalitarian.
Yeah, it is. Although, of course, not everybody did get a number, and there were racial disparities.
Yeah, of course, of course. And we have spoken about this on this program, and there should be an asterisk on everything that we're talking about in this context.
We're talking about
a narrow set of Americans, or I should say maybe a wide set, but there were certainly huge swaths of Americans who were left out. People of color and women were, you know, in some respects, you know, targeted to not receive Social Security benefits at that time.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, the larger point, I think, is really important. And often, especially these days when we're so concerned about documentation and identity theft and data breaches, the larger point is that, you know, identification by the federal government, being visible to the federal government in this case because of a benefits program, was very, very, very valuable. It was a kind of prized possession. And this is why Social Security numbers played a different role in Americans' lives then, right? So to hold on to this number, to be able to recall it, to be able to, you know, produce it, was seen as something really precious. So, of course, you know, its history would zigzag on from there and start, you know, we now think of them quite differently. But documentation and identification could be really, really sought after kinds of statuses for Americans, right? So anyway, I feel like that's a really important point to make because it helps us see that there's not an inevitable relationship between kind of negative surveillance and documentation, right? There
right.
can be other arrangements, yeah.
And then that everything turns a little bit south, in part because there's a desire to make the Soviet Union more nefarious, but also it seems in part because our government started to snoop on its own citizens in a particularly aggressive fashion, right? When we get into the late 60s and early 70s. And how does that impact privacy there? Because I imagine there's also this dynamic of, that there's a portion of the American public that's going, well, the government's, you know, spying and but they're spying on all the right people in the country.
Right. Yeah. So there are actually, of course, you know, long history of the U.S. government, the FBI, spying on citizens. It's on American citizens. But what changes, I suppose, in the mid 20th century is that this becomes much more obvious and much more publicized and, you know, politicized in a sense, because it's not simply aliens and radicals as it was during World War One, but there's a kind of, you know, McCarthyist sweep and you know, a real debate that breaks out about the reach of the federal government and its kind of inquisitorial powers at the same time as you have non-state actors that seem to have powers to intrude and invade into Americans' you know, deeply intimate personal psychological lives through all kinds of new techniques. And some of those are adopted by the state and some aren't, but I'm thinking about things like, you know, psychological exams, personality testing at the workplace, various kinds of experiments to see how far you can get into people's consciousness and so forth. And so a whole new domain opens up around psychological invasions in the 1950s and 60s, again, only partly furthered by the state, but certainly, you know, gets more attention probably because of the public knowledge about U.S. surveillance of its own citizens and, you know, undemocratic kinds of trials, right, and people losing their jobs because of suspected communist or radical associations. So the 50s and 60s sees this really quite anxious and urgent debate about the shrinking space of privacy in American life and will, you know, give rise to certain kinds of solutions or remedies. One of which, I mean, not directly, but is, I think, in response to all of this, is, you know, finally a right to privacy as announced in the Supreme Court in 1965 on the case Griswold v. Connecticut, but also legislation, pretty far-reaching legislation like the Privacy Act of 1974. So there is a kind of response in terms of thinking about how to regulate and guard Americans' privacy, both their information privacy and their kind of privacy full stop. Those are not very effective remedies, and so the debate goes on.
Well, what's fascinating about that here is you have Griswold, which, of course, was about birth control, and mm-hmm. And ultimately became, in some respects, a foundation for Roe v. Wade. But simultaneously, yes. You also had people moving what was previously considered in the private realm to more to the public realm, right? Like, I mean, broadly speaking, their sexuality and their other things are now more transparent. So there's like a paradox there. It's being almost like legalized on some, you know, there's a legal structure that's being built, but society, the mores change.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, this is what makes this is what makes privacy such a fascinating, but also really challenging topic, I think, to get our heads around, because lots of things are moving at any given point. And what does happen, I think, the 70s are really critical for this. What's happening there is both more sensitivity to certain kinds of privacy invasions, one's data, identifying materials, anything that might be used in a kind of discriminatory fashion against them. At the same time that, yes, there's been a liberalization around certain kinds of personal material that would have been guarded very carefully in the 19th century and through the first half of the 20th century, but suddenly has been destigmatized. So sexuality, divorce, family dysfunction, alcoholism, and various kinds of medical conditions, right? So there were social movements that sort of were behind those, and were the feminist movement, maybe first and foremost, but also gay liberation, also various kinds of other social movements that made those things as a political project less shameful, right? But at the same time, it's not as if there aren't other kinds of pieces of information that seem damaging in a different way. And this is where we start getting into worries that come along with a network society, with computer data banks, a computer that never forgets, as people would start to say. In the 1960s. So I think you see a kind of rise of information privacy concerns and calls to regulate corporate and government uses of identifying information, at the same time that you see a kind of freeing of other kinds of personal and intimate details. And that's not even getting, you know, into the 80s and 90s and confessional memoirs and social media and blogs and so forth, right? It's already there, really, in the 1970s.
Right.
It's a psychological and a political movement, really.
So that dynamic carries through almost up until, you know, this sort of, we're in a new age now. And I would imagine, like, I mean, so the, you know, largely the story of your book is that privacy is a sort of, in a constant, it's never static. It's a constantly changing concept, and I imagine now the departure. Particularly, I got to imagine, you know, I have a teenage daughter, that the concept of privacy for her is so radically different than it has been at any other stage, right? Because so much of what had been considered private, even 20 years ago, is now like, we just throw that out the door now. Like, we literally shove it out in the front yard.
Or the screen, or yeah, right. Whatever the equivalent is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there are continuities, though, even in the differences. So I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, there is a kind of freedom with which people share certain kinds of personal narratives and experiences that would have been, you know, utterly incomprehensible to someone like Louis Brandeis in 1890. On the other hand, to my mind, that some of the best studies of, say, teenage Social media use, Dana Boyd's work, for example, suggests that teenagers are just as concerned about privacy as people have been, their parents are, but in a different way, and are figuring out different ways on a new platform to protect information that they only want to share with a few or want to share with no one versus the kind of information they're willing to broadcast more widely. So I think the tension remains. I don't think we're what we're seeing is a kind of abandonment of privacy. In fact, on the contrary, I would say, looking historically, you know, we're in a moment where people are thinking about and caring about privacy probably more than they have since at least the 1970s. Right now, so it's a little bit hard to decipher. But I think what we're seeing is a resetting of the terms, maybe, while also realizing how little control any of us has given what's already occurred, right? That so much of our information is already out there in the world, and we aren't going to be able to wrench it back in very easily. In fact, that's probably, you know, a game we can't even play. So when I think about our current moment, what strikes me is that what we're seeing is that collision or the crossing of two different trends. One is this one we were talking about earlier, which is the kind of letting go of and destigmatizing of certain kinds of personal information, which has led people to very freely talk about, write about, share information about themselves, with an intensely profitable and sophisticated data mining, landscape that's come into place and was not related to that first trend, but is now, you know, able to use all that stuff that's out there in new ways and really threatening and unsettling ways. So I think that's generating, you know, our current debate and our current predicament, which is a pretty hard one for us to resolve, obviously.
How much of that paradox is a function of like a push for, it seems to me, in the late 20th century and the early 21st century, sort of a bunch of private public type initiatives, right? Which was a big push, which essentially, you know, implies that the government trusts these private entities to do a lot of this stuff, right? Like, you know, from prisons to farming out, immigration services, to farming out, to get data on behalf of the government, et cetera. And then there's sort of this whiplash with like, oh, wait a second. They have a different agenda, and we can't trust Facebook or whatnot.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think, my historian self would say, well, of course, there have always been these blurry, very blurry lines between corporate America and the government. I'm thinking back to the kind of use of the telegraph lines by the federal government, ability to, sort of get into private communications and to subpoena corporate information, for example. So that goes way back. But I think, nevertheless, you're right that there has been a kind of tendency to both to privatize public goods or public functions, which is part of this. Even the Social Security number fits into this because a number that was meant to be only an identification of a federal account, essentially, retirement account, became a kind of number that was used by insurance agencies and credit bureaus and all kinds of other private corporations to do their work. So that, yes, that kind of pooling or sharing of information, whether intentional or not, you know, whether the U.S. government is cooperating with Google or Google is cooperating with U.S. government, the fact that this information is seems to be porous and accessible has certainly contributed to our current problems because it becomes very unclear who is responsible ultimately for what information is being collected, how it's being used, how it's moving around, whether it can be stopped, whether it can ever be erased. You know, those are, I think, some of our most important debates right now, and they're very hard to figure out because it's pretty unclear, either technologically or politically, what the limits to information sharing may be.
Indeed. It's fascinating, a book, The Known Citizen, A History of Privacy in Modern America. Professor Sarah Igo, thanks so much for your time today. I also have to just add, it just occurs to me, too, like that Social Security number, huge, huge financial gift to the private industry.
Yes.
Right. I mean,
right.
What would they do? What would they do if they didn't have that number?
Exactly.
Across platforms to from everything to do with credit and identification. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
They're totally unintended.
We will put a link to The Known Citizen at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate
it. Wonderful. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm going to add that to my list of you think you built that? I would like to see 90%. Look, your landlords, your loans, your banking institutions, your phone companies, any, like, all, how many services ask for your Social Security number? And they all do that because of the tremendous amount of value they have in relying on that number and the information that that sort of trails around with it. Businesses would not be able to function. You could have a million different, like, Equifaxes and this and that, but if there wasn't a standard number, you would be SOL.
You're welcome.
So you're welcome for that, generic libertarian I'm having an argument with in my head.
How often does that happen during the day?
I would say like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, I would imagine. I could literally see you, like, I don't know, shuffling out of a post office or something and be like, exactly, and that's why that works.
That's,
and you don't understand.
Honestly.
Person in my head I'm arguing with who's dumb.
Honestly, I would say that happens at least like twice a day. I mean, I don't always land on something.
I was going to say, maybe.
I don't always land on something 2 or 3 times a day at least. I don't know. I'm not always landing on something. I could be reiterating something.
That's why I made your point before.
Like I said yesterday and the day before and the day before that and then the day before that.
No, that's when it gets really disturbing.
Well,
you've really been brought into this when you're like in your apartment relitigating some argument with like a random caller from 6 months ago.
I got news for you.
Jesus Christ, I need to get away from Sam.
You just described my life. Just describe my life.
What about the roads?
The only break I get from that is arguing with my daughter.
I was imagining. I could see your kids being like, Dad, stop. You're frightening me.
Right.
Who built the roads? Dad, I need lunch. Stop.
Exactly.
You're scaring me.
Folks, just a reminder. Let's play that clip. I want to play that clip before we go. As a way of reminding you what's going to happen this evening on the show, here is this is CNN. Is this that? Who is that dude? That's not. It's Avalon.
Yeah.
Jeez, that guy has been around for a long time. A lot of different incarnations.
You know, what's his? I actually know where this guy got his start.
From Bloomberg for Bloomberg.
Giuliani speechwriter.
He was Giuliani speechwriter, and then he migrated into being one of those guys like in the early aughts, I think, who was like sort of a centrist. Like he was heavily branded as a centrist. Oh, really? Is that right?
New York Times story about how there can be love across the aisle.
They're beloved across. Wait, which aisle? Are they on
the
same aisle?
Center right
there. They're loved between the center right and the center righter.
I don't totally hate gay people, and we both support cutting capital gains. It's a really
it's not. I don't totally hate gay people. It's like I like the gay people I know in my own life,
right?
But generally speaking, I'm not going to go to bat.
Or more
for
like, gay people are fine. Black people are terrifying.
Yeah.
Cut the capital gains rate.
But nevertheless, he's been reborn. Is he a CNN? He seems like more than a contributor here.
He does the reality checks.
Thank you. We needed that. Here's a reality check for you tonight. You'd think it's just the State of the Union, but it's something else.
Welcome to Super Bowl for policy wonks. The State of the Union is here. And tonight, President Trump will
pause
offer
it for one second.
It's already
I imagine
so bad.
There's a lot of you who have just tried to commit suicide after But just to hang in there, it gets worse.
Maybe he was saying like the Super Bowl was boring this year.
I didn't find
giving him way too much credit.
I didn't find the Super Bowl boring. I thought it was pretty exciting, and I love the way that it finished. But continue.
Welcome to Super Bowl for policy wonks. The State of the Union is here. And tonight, President Trump will offer his scripted vision of governing in a constitutionally mandated report to Congress. Now, he enters the arena with a robust economy but barrel-scraping approval rating, fresh off the longest government shutdown in history. What's worse, a new CNN poll shows that 43% of Americans say the federal government's doing the worst job of governing in their lifetime. But there's always a chance that a strong speech could leave analysts saying that tonight was the night that Donald Trump finally became president.
I like how he
hell yeah, dude.
He one steps that away from him, right? He doesn't say a good speech could be the night the president finally becomes president. He instead says that analysts could say that. Yeah. Yeah. That's the classic. Some say I'm not.
Some
saying,
say
some
I could become president tonight.
Some say I could.
Some people are saying I could be president tonight.
Tonight's
some
the night people are I could become it. President.
Well, analysts can be gullible, so
that
he's
kid
right.
got and bullied and because his last name was Trump. I've never felt more just a vis. What's that feeling where someone else's pain becomes your pain? I've never had that before, but this kid. He's got this beautiful last name.
Beautiful last name.
And they're mocking him.
Can't be best.
It just makes me feel it. What's that feeling in your stomach where you feel a concern for another human being?
I've heard people describe it to me. It's not hunger.
It's not hunger. I'm not hangry either. It feels like.
I'll tell you what's going to be fascinating.
It's what they said Schindler's List was like, but I fell asleep 5 minutes in.
I'll tell you what's going to be fascinating. And I'll probably repeat myself before the thing, but if he does try to make this like about like I want the country to come together, and I want to reach put an olive branch out to Nancy Pelosi. It's going to be fascinating to see, and his approval rating will move on that. But it is going to be a function of just how deluded and absent the American public is to see how far up it moves.
And that's another segment of Blaming the Electorate.
I got another one of those segments coming right up. All I'm doing now is just I'm writing the book
tonight,
in my head.
Tonight, analysts say it might move the needle, and they could be right. But that's because you never bet against the stupidity, lack of informedness, and general ignorance of the American people.
That is not it. It is far more active. It's not ignorant. I'm sorry.
They're
if
robustly
you watch,
stupid.
It's just the desperate desire to have things to be living in a delusion.
Right.
And that, I mean, because honestly, like you have to be. I can understand why people support him because there are, hateful, racist types out there who feel they're under siege. What I don't understand is that, like, you know, he was pretty nice in that speech. I changed my opinion about that guy. That, to me, just seems nuts. All right, folks.
That is actually pretty nuts.
It's pretty nuts. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. And when we do, we don't have a post roll. No.
No post rolls. You nailed them.
And here is what's going to happen. We're going to be live streaming tonight, 8:30 p.m. We will have a show tomorrow. It will be an interview that I think that we have pre-recorded. So we will have a new show for you tomorrow. But we're not going to come in late. And just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Always free shipping. And tonight is Tuesday night. There is no Michael Brooks show, but it will be Thursday or last Thursday, depending on your preference.
It'll be on this Thursday's special Michael Brooks show. Jeffrey Halper, who's the head of Israelis Against Housing Demolition, is going to join us and talk about one state democracy, home demolition, anti-home demolition activism. Then Brianna Joy Gray of The Intercept is going to talk about Kamala Harris's prosecutorial record, her political history, and we'll dissect the State of the Union illicit history this weekend with Zach Carter of the 1990s, why Howard Schultz's whole campaign is a giant sort of exercise in desperation to reverse the clock among America's elites back to the 1990s. We'll explain what that means. Good couple with the third way illicit history. Patreon.com/TMBS. Also, of course, on YouTube and iTunes.
Jamie, the Antifada.
Yeah, so this week on All in the Antifada Family, we are joined by some longtime listeners who've been with us since the beginning to discuss the nefarious role of Vladimir Putin in undermining not just American democracy, but everyday freedoms in all of our lives in the greatest nation on earth. We also have a group sing-along, and it was very cool to have all of our excellent listeners right here with us, IRL. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada. I also want to give a little shout-out to Comrade Ted Leo for inviting us at North Brooklyn DSA to have a table at his show this past weekend. It was a lot of fun.
Sweet. He's the one who provided us with our daily opening version of Pressure Drop.
Ted Leo's awesome. He's the real deal, both in terms of obviously he's a good musician, but very committed to this stuff. He's a good, really good person.
Yeah, he said very nice things about us too on the stage. Made us feel great. And we got like 10 signups, so
sweet.
It was a good night.
The most recent literary hangover, I didn't really remember this, but it's actually kind of topical with the Northam minstrel blackface stuff, because we go into the early history of that sort of in the 1830s. That was one of the original sort of mass cultures. And we go into that a little bit, so check it out, folks.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. Be right back. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.